Rusty Quill presents The Magnus Archives. Episode 46, Literary Heights.
Statement of Herbert Knox regarding a repeat customer to his bookshop in Chichester. Original statement given December 21st, 1998. Audio recording by Jonathan Sims, head archivist of the Magnus Institute, London. Statement begins. It's hard to know exactly where to begin when explaining to you what exactly it was that I experienced. There were many things that happened, each strange and inexplicable in and of itself, but I'll be damned if I can see how they connect to each other, except that they all ended up involving the same student from the university. His name was Michael Crewe, though he normally went by Mike, at least to me. I'm not usually one to pay much attention to the students that come into my shop, especially during the start of a new school year. I have something of a soft spot for the antique when it comes to my furnishings, and that, combined with the age of my stock, means that when new students arrive at the university, they generally regard the discovery of Lion Street books as something of a curiosity. I've heard more than one comparison to that shop in Stephen King's Needful Things, or whatever it was called. Anyway, as I deal mostly in rare books and antiquities, they generally get one look at the prices, and suddenly their interest dries up. Of course, there are always a couple of rich kids whose parents weren't able to buy their way into Oxbridge, so it's not a complete waste. So it's rare that I have any cause to remember the face of my student customers. But Mike struck me the moment he walked into my shop. This would have been last September. I don't remember the exact date, though I'm sure if I looked up my receipts I could tell you. He was short, barely over 5 feet, and very thin. Underfed, I remember thinking. It hadn't yet turned cold, but he wore a high-collared coat and a thick scarf wrapped around his neck. Now I'm getting on in years, and much as I love my shop, the building can get a bit drafty come autumn, so I generally have the heating up quite high. It was clearly enough for him to become uncomfortable wrapped up like that, and he removed the scarf to reveal a branching pattern of white scar tissue arcing up the side of his neck. That was interesting, certainly, but it wasn't what actually caught my eye. No, what struck me most was that, rather than wonder or curiosity, as I would see in the faces of the other students who found their way into Lion Street books, this young man began scanning the shelves with an expression that seemed more like impatience. He was clearly looking for something specific, so after a few minutes I asked him if I could help. Without looking up, he said he was after a copy of De Plancey's Dictionnaire Infernal, The Older the Better. I only had a 1908 translation in stock, but I said I would make inquiries if he wished for an older edition. He didn't reply to this, nor to my casual inquiry as to whether he was studying demonology or the occult. He took it to my desk to buy it, and I started rooting around for the credit card machine, when I smelt the strangest thing. It was like just before a storm breaks, that sharp smell in the air, but looking outside, the sky was clear and the sun was shining. Mike seemed to smell it too, and he went very still. He reached into his jacket and pulled out a wad of cash. He quickly counted it out, grabbed the book, and was through the door before I even had a chance to ring him up a receipt. The smell faded as soon as he was out of sight. I didn't know his name at that point, but it was far from the last time I saw him. He became something of a regular. Maybe once every 3 weeks or so he'd come in and check any new stock I had. He was interested in spiritualism, history of witchcraft, anything mystical, especially from before 1850. He also bought a few books on meteorology, especially pre-Enlightenment, and once a book on the work of Gottfried Leibniz, though I don't remember the title. I have no idea where he was getting his money, but he had a lot of it. He was able to pay 5 figures for a copy of a 1559 printing of the Malleus Maleficarum without breaking a sweat. At some point I learned his name. I mean, I certainly wouldn't have described him as a friend, or even close, but over the last year he'd easily been my most regular customer. That wasn't the only time I smelled that acrid tang in the air, though. Sometimes when he was in there, it would come again all at once. It never seemed to be coming from Mike, exactly. But when he was around, the smell would just suddenly be there. It was the only time I would ever smell it inside, and when I did, Mike would just stop whatever he was doing and leave immediately. He wouldn't run. He'd just leave. There was another thing, too. Whenever he was in, the light bulbs in my shop would burn brighter. I didn't even realize this until he'd been coming for several months, as it was usually in daylight when he went shopping. But when winter made its presence known, his late afternoon visits began to take place after dark, and I noticed that whenever he came in, the shop got brighter. The bulbs would start to buzz very softly, and the elements within them would glow with a surprising intensity. There was this strange electric crackling, and once I even got a shock when I turned a lamp on. I never brought it up with Mike, though. I don't even know how I would have gone about bringing it up. It was February when I got the Leitner book. I'd heard of him before, of course, though I'd never met the man. The rare book trade is a comparatively small world, at least within the UK, and his name would often come up whenever I was gossiping with my peers. Sometimes it was about which valuable piece he'd snatched for a fraction of its true value, or the ridiculous amounts he'd paid for a book that everyone else was sure was a fake. Occasionally there were more unsavory rumours about his personal life. So, even though I'd never personally made his acquaintance, I was well aware of Jürgen Leitner and his collection. And when he disappeared in 1994, I was one of the many that heard whispers on the grapevine that a few of his books were back in circulation. I never thought I'd actually get my hands on one, though. Not until I heard about Kirsten's death. Kirsten Baumann was a book dealer friend of mine down in Salisbury. I suppose you could call her a rival in some ways, but we'd always been very friendly. In fact, there were a few years back in the 80s when we were very friendly indeed. But we hadn't spoken much in the last year or two. Well, in January of this year, she passed away. Lost balance on the stairs and broke her neck. To be honest, I wasn't as surprised by her death as I might have been, though it was rather alarming. Over the last few years, the landscape of the UK rare books trade has changed significantly. A lot of the big names in the old guard have gone missing or retired, or sometimes even been found dead. The police even got involved for a while, as there was talk of maybe someone out there targeting booksellers, but they never found anything to indicate it was anything other than a coincidence. I suppose it's just an example of how one generation inevitably makes way for the next, but Kirsten was the first time it had affected someone I knew well. What surprised me more than her death, however, was that she had made me her literary executor, and left me the vast majority of her stock. So it was I came into the possession of a Leitner. It was a strange one, all right. Exaltiora, or From the Heights, was the name. It was custom-bound in the late 1800s, from what I could see, though the pages looked to be significantly older than that, 17th century, I would have said. It was written in Latin, and seemed to be a long poem in the style of Virgil, illustrated with some quite striking woodcuts. It told the tale of a small, unnamed town high on a clifftop that sees a monstrous creature begin to approach. The poem is unclear whether it is a beast, a demon, or a god, as it uses the words interchangeably, but it is seen far off, its head and body lost among the clouds. The majority of the story details the villagers' attempts to prepare to do battle against this creature, but each time they devise a countermeasure, the thing gets closer and is shown to be far larger than previously suspected, rendering their preparations insignificant. At last, when it is almost upon them, its impossible vastness undeniable, the villagers surrender to despair and hurl themselves from the clifftop onto the rocks far below. It was a strange book, and made all the stranger by the fact that it appeared to be utterly unique. I could find no record of it in any catalogue I had available, and after a few calls to a couple of museums and archives I knew dealt with similar texts, I was convinced that this may well have been a completely unique book. This didn't please me as much as you might imagine, because what it meant was that I had an artifact on my hands, one that belonged far more in a museum than it did in a library. I'd only had a museum-worthy book come once before, and the process of authentication and the work involved in selling it had quite frankly not been worth the amount that I sold it for. Museums are not as well-funded as private collectors. Beyond that, there was something about the book itself that unsettled me. Reading it was disorientating, in a way that I can't easily put into words, especially the woodcuts, although they were just the village, or the cliffs, or empty forests or mountains. They were quite crude in many ways, but certainly not unsettling. And yet twice when reading it and observing the woodcuts, I fell off my chair. Over the week I possessed it, I had enough dizzy spells that I had to book an appointment with my doctor, although at the time I didn't make any direct connection between them and the book. I had bad dreams as well. I don't recall them with any clarity, but I'm rather sure they were dreams of falling. Mike came in at the end of that week. I wouldn't go so far as to say I was expecting him, but I'd put a half dozen books to one side for his consideration, as I assumed he'd be in at some point soon. As was his habit, he said almost nothing, and the cold February air was enough that he didn't even feel the need to remove his scarf, so only the faintest hints of that branching scar could be seen creeping out from below it. The bulbs crackled and brightened in his presence, and I presented the books I had chosen to him. He spent some minutes looking through them before pushing them back with a shake of the head. This was not unusual for him, and I took it as no insult. I turned to put them back on the shelf when I was almost overcome by a wave of dizziness. I gripped the back of my chair and steadied myself. When I looked back at Mike, he was staring at the Lightner book with a wild expression I had never seen on his face before. He pointed at Ex Altiora and asked me how much it was. I started to tell him it wasn't for sale, but he had this look in his eyes, this furious desperation. It scared me, to be honest, and I had a sudden sense that this man was willing to kill me for that book. All this, combined with the discomfort I felt with the thing anyway, was just a bit too much for me. I named a figure that I thought was maybe double what it was actually worth, and Mike wrote me out a check so fast that I thought his pen would go clean through the paper. For this, I insisted on ringing him up a receipt, and without another word, he was out into the rainy February afternoon. And that would have been it.